Welcome to Evidence Based, a new Harbinger psychology podcast. I'm your host, Cassie Stossel. On today's episode, we're discussing relationship, sexuality, and consent for teen girls. We're joined by Leah, Gary, and Geraldine O'Sullivan, authors of The Girl's Guide to Relationships, Sexuality, and Consent. Leah is a licensed clinical social worker practicing in San Diego, California. She works primarily with teens and adults who've experienced complex trauma, including childhood abuse, domestic violence, and dating violence, and provides trauma-based treatment, including EMDR. Geraldine O'Sullivan is a licensed clinical social worker with a pupil personnel services credential in school social work and child welfare and attendance. She currently practices as a school social worker in San Diego County, California, where she provides mental health counseling services and crisis intervention to teens using therapeutic modalities, including cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational interviewing, and solution-focused therapy. In 2022, she was awarded High School Social Worker of the Year for San Diego County. Hi, Leah and Geraldine. It's so great to have you on Evidence Based. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
So I wanted to get our very important conversation started out with talking about the importance of these conversations that teens can have about relationship, sexuality, and consent. Can you talk about why those are so important?
We are very much familiar with the lack of education that a lot of kids have in regards to the nature of relationships. A lot of the education is really based on safe sex and just the idea of consent. And it's very limited in nature and how to have uncomfortable conversations, the skills that they need to learn to navigate these conversations, both with peers and people that they're dating and having relationships with. So really, we're trying to bring awareness to the skills and the reality of teens today and how they need to navigate these difficult conversations without having much to go off of, basically. A lot of parents are, I think we're at a different place where parents are a little bit more engaged, a little bit more open, but we're still tiptoeing around the issue a lot. So our book really addresses the need for these conversations and just being real and relatable in that these conversations are expected and will happen. And so we want to set teens and parents up even too for success.
And what are some difficulties that teens are facing in the current environment?
It's, you know, it's a broad question. And I think that as, you know, for teens and for adults since the pandemic, we've seen just an increase in anxiety and depression. And I think the stressors that are going on right now for our teens in the school system have been really intense. In terms of relationships, friendships, and dating, I think some of the difficulties that go on for teens right now has a lot to do with their form of communication and the kind of the social and digital media that they're, you know, encountering every day, and just how that has changed social interactions over the years. And so currently, I think it can be hard for teens when they're communicating with one another through various like platforms to really understand the nuances of tone and to be able to communicate in a way that's clear and effective. So that's a challenge that I think they're dealing with. And in our book, we really openly address that challenge and kind of how to communicate across different forums, whether it's in person or online or through messaging. That seems to be a challenge that we've noticed.
I also think there's the political climate I want to add and how a lot of kids are fearful of their futures and their ability to make decisions for themselves, to be who they want to be and who they are. And so I've seen in my practice and with youth just this fear too about being able to show up as their authentic selves and have that be accepted and feel safe as well.
Yeah, that safety is really important. You both write a lot about the best way for girls to identify and connect with their values. Can you talk about why this is important, especially before getting into relationships?
Oftentimes, kids and adults get into relationships without knowing or without really considering what's important to them, what is the foundation of their identity, and what really matters in their life and in terms of a relationship. And so they go into a relationship usually strictly based off feelings or insecurities, not considering their values, meaning what's really important to them as an individual. So whether it's family, whether it's education, whether it's healthy lifestyle, whether it's, you know, spirituality, this is very uncommon for adults. So for kids to have the ability to self-reflect and think, oh, does my partner respect these values? Do we align in these values? Are we going to be in the middle with these values? That's absent in most relationships. So by giving teens the tools to really clarify and identify their values and make decisions that are based in their value system, it's important because then they can make decisions that feel confident, that feel true to them, that feel safe, that really, again, reflects who they are. And oftentimes kids will get in relationships, not just romantic relationships, but peer relationships that are at odds with their identity and what's important to them. And that can create a lot of anxiety and cognitive dissonance, meaning they might feel like uncomfortable in these groups of friends or with this partner because it doesn't feel right. It doesn't honor the things that matter to them. And not that think you have to share the exact same values as everyone, but when you do express your values and know what they are, you can navigate difficult situations easier.
And just a follow-up to that, is it common when you're identifying those values for some of them to maybe clash with each other? And if so, what do you do when that happens?
Absolutely. I think we all have different values and hierarchy of values. So, you know, for a lot of teens, like their personal values might be at odds with some of their family values, but family might be important to them. So it's hard when you're a teenager and entering adulthood and making decisions that are based on maybe, you know, maybe you're trying to pursue traveling and their family's like, I want, you know, we as a family are living in the same area. We're very collective in nature. And so that can be at odds, traveling and exploring the world and having new experiences with their value to be close and involved in their family. So this is definitely very common. And you see this with kids or teens in their relationships as well.
And what are some ways that girls can begin to communicate those values in a relationship?
I would say a lot of it is first being able to reflect and consider what is important to me and why is this coming up right now for me, and communicating that using I statements. So for example, if they're in a relationship, a peer relationship, romantic relationship, communicating, this doesn't feel okay for me because it goes against, you know, my need to wait to be intimate, for using the dating situation. My need to wait to be intimate with someone I feel like I can trust and feel safe with, for example. Kids don't really have that language, but I think if they can reflect and be like, why is it important for me to wait to have sex with a partner? Why is it important for me to not make fun of someone at school? If they can communicate it, it's easier to stand their ground because they're certain and they know why, like what they stand for. And it's easier to feel confident in expressing values when you know what they are.
One thing I appreciated about your book is the majority of the beginning part is working on yourself and exploring those values. And then you also write about negative self-talk. Can you talk about what that is and what are some ways to move into that positive self-talk?
So when we think about self-talk, it's kind of that inner voice that we have going on in our heads. And so it's the way that we talk to ourselves when we're just alone with our thoughts or, you know, our inner dialogue that we have. So negative self-talk for teens can happen in a lot of different ways. It can relate to their body image. It could relate to their social skills. It could relate to their academic skills. I'll give an example of a student who's taking a test and they don't do as well as they hope to on the test. So negative self-talk would look like, I'm so stupid. I can't believe I, you know, didn't pass this test or didn't do as well as I should have. What's wrong with me? I know I could have done better, like those, that kind of negative language that they use. And then a way to shift that to positive self-talk, and this can be really hard for teens that are struggling with self-esteem. And so it can be hard to know exactly how they should talk to themselves. So one of the pieces of guidance that we give in the book is to think about how they would talk to a close friend and to say, well, if your close friend came to you and told you that they didn't do well in the test, would you say, oh my gosh, you're so stupid, you could have totally done better? No, they wouldn't say that, obviously. They would say things like, it's okay, you know, you can study more next time, it'll be okay the next time you take a test. You know, they'll give some reassurance and some more compassion. And so part of the guidance for with our self-talk is to have, when we think about how we would talk to a close friend, it allows space for having more self-compassion. And when we have that, that talk will become healthier. So the first step is awareness. A lot of times people aren't even aware of how they talk to themselves. Kids, adults, a lot of people have this inner voice going on and they're not even really recognizing what they're saying to themselves or the language that they're using. So once they become aware of it, then the second step is to kind of work on changing it and to think about how they could be kinder to themselves.
And why is that important to sort of shift that thinking, especially before going into relationships?
Yeah. So I think that as we can shift that language, if we can have more self-compassion and if we can be more positive in our self-talk, then that helps to build our self-esteem and it also helps to build our self-confidence. And that allows us to, in relationships and for teens, to be able to assert themselves in relationships, to be able to communicate effectively with a partner and to have that strong foundation. And that doesn't mean that people can't or shouldn't date if they're not there yet. You know, we're all a work in progress. But I think that being able to build that self-esteem and that self-confidence can really help teens when they are dating and communicating with their partners.
And as teens are, you know, learning to talk to themselves more positively, they're finding their values. What are some ways that teens can begin to explore their sexual identities?
Part of exploring your sexual identity is really being aware of what you gravitate towards. So part of sexual identity is who you're attracted to, who you want, who you have, the types of people you naturally gravitate towards and have romantic feelings for and feel attracted to and want to share intimate experiences with. It can also be what you prefer, like how you like to show affection and how you like to express affection and love towards other people. So really your preferences and how you feel about love and your romantic relationships. And I mean, it's a huge umbrella. So under sexual identity, there's sexual orientation. So the gender or the sex that you typically are attracted to. There's also gender expression and how you express your gender, and there's gender identity, which is really the gender you identify with, or maybe you don't identify with one particular gender and it's more gender fluid. So if you were assigned male at birth, maybe you really actually truly feel more feminine and you're really trying to navigate this world as someone who's feminine, even if you've been assigned male at birth. So sexual identity, I mean, there's a huge umbrella, but under that is sexual orientation, which is who you're generally attracted to, who you have romantic relationships with. And then gender identity is how you identify as far as your gender, or if you even do have a preference.
And what are some ways that teens can deal with others not understanding their gender identity or their sexual identity?
I think a lot of it is connecting to safe adults, having access to resources, people and groups and communities that are open-minded and expansive and offer support in helping youth and just individuals explore their identities. So being in safe spaces where they can talk freely about who they are, question who maybe the identity that's been imposed on them. And I also think too, really going to people within their school administration that are also safe. So whether it's school social worker, counselor, it's a safe teacher, there's a bunch of clubs, you know, that campuses and schools offer now. So really the idea of finding community and safe places that offer that space. As well as, I mean, I think it's really hard, and oftentimes kids have to hide from their families this part of them. And so it's navigating a world where they can find, again, just safe people if it isn't within their families, if there are no safe adults in their families.
And I think this leads us to talk a little bit about choosing your friend circle. In your book, you talk about the importance of that. What are some tips if you have identified a friend who has not been supportive or positive in your life?
So I think for teens, this can be challenging because their friendships are changing so rapidly at such a formative time. And the other thing about, you know, being in school is that sometimes you are forced to interact with different people, whether it's groups in your classes, group projects, classes that you have with other people. And so typically a lot of teens will form friendships through the classes that they have with other students. But then what also happens is that then if that friendship isn't working out, it can be challenging when they're still interacting with that person in school on a regular basis. And so I think what teens have to consider when they have identified someone in their life that it's no longer, that relationship is maybe no longer serving them, or the friendship has become unhealthy, is how to navigate, how to communicate with that friend regarding what's going on. And so that's where things like I statements can be really helpful, because as human beings, we tend to get a little defensive if someone is telling us something that we've done wrong, but using I statements helps to remove that defensiveness. And so essentially what you're doing is starting a sentence with I instead of with you. And so you're saying something like, I felt hurt when this happened, for example, instead of you lied to me, or whatever the case may be. So A lot of times what we encourage teens to do is to use I statements when they're talking to a friend about maybe something that has happened that has hurt them. Something that's a little unique to the school system is that like they also have the option to work through some of the friendship challenges through like mediation with a counselor or a social worker. That can sometimes be really helpful in using restorative practices to restore the relationship and something that has gone wrong. So teens kind of have to ask themselves, like, do I want to work through this issue that's going on in the friendship? And do I still want to have this friendship? Or do I need to, you know, part ways with this person? And what will that look like? And so those can be complicated situations for them to navigate. And fortunately, there is support in the school systems to help them with those challenges. But that's some of the tips that we discuss in the book for that topic.
I like that, empowering them to sort of know if this is a friendship they want to work on, continue, versus just like being put into the friend group and forced to hang out with them. I think that's really empowering for them to learn to question if that's worth it for them. And why is learning assertiveness important? And what are some ways for teens to assert themselves?
I really like to talk to teens about assertiveness. I think it is an important skill to develop. And I think especially for girls and women, this idea of assertiveness is sometimes confused with rudeness. And so a lot of times what I talk to teens about is that it is okay to be assertive, and it's definitely possible to do that in a way that is still respectful and still kind. And so we talk about it as it pertains to relationships, but also, you know, teens can struggle with this when they're trying to assertively communicate with a parent or with a teacher, and they're trying to get their point across, but they're also trying to be mindful and respectful of someone who's older than them, right? And so a lot of it is showing some guidance and showing some examples to them of how you can be assertive and still be respectful and kind. And being assertive doesn't have to mean that you're being rude or that you're being bossy or pushy or something like that. Especially when it comes to relationships or intimacy, it is very important for young teens to feel confident in their ability to assert their needs and their limits and their boundaries, and to be able to have the language to do that. And so in our book, we discuss ways that they can communicate assertively and respectfully.
I think that's important to note, because I think assertiveness has gotten this really negative connotation, especially for women. So I like the redefining of what that means, really. In your book, you talk about how unhealthy relationships are often associated only with physical abuse, but there's more to it than that. Can you talk about other signs of an unhealthy relationship?
I think we see within teens and even just adults, they see abuse or unhealthy relationships being extreme cases. So extreme acts of violence, pushing, shoving, hitting, or using really obscene and egregious language, like calling someone a bitch, slut, labeling someone, right, in those ways. However, it can be not even subtle. It doesn't have to be extreme to be abusive or unhealthy. And part of our book is bringing awareness that relationships, there are levels of abuse, and there are different types of abuse, and there's even subtle forms of abuse that slowly make you feel worse and worse and worse. And that's part of the abusive behavior and cycle of abuse. So for example, if someone's making sarcastic remarks and jokes at your expense all the time, it might not feel abusive because it doesn't seem so egregious. It doesn't seem so awful. They're not using terrible language, but it can chip away at your self-esteem and self-worth, and is used oftentimes as a means of control.
Earning your continuing education hours doesn't have to be a painful experience. The right course can open your mind to new possibilities, increase your confidence, and hand you powerful tools to transform your clients' lives. Praxis Continuing Education and Training teams up with some of the brightest minds in mental health to provide cutting-edge, evidence-based training for practitioners. You can learn firsthand from experts like Stephen C. Hayes, Kelly Wilson, Robin Walzer, Kirk Strozzle, and many others. Find your next training at praxisCET.com. That's praxisCET.com. Two terms that you write about that I think are very in the public, you know, language now are gaslighting and love bombing. Can you talk about what those are and the differences between the two and what that might look like?
Yeah. So love bombing is usually part of the cycle of abuse. So in any abusive relationship dynamic, including friendships, love bombing is essentially the act or pattern of behavior in which one person is doing grand gestures to show affection and love for a person, but as a means of manipulation. So it's doing, like, you know, overwhelming your partner with gifts and words of affirmation and telling them, I love you all the time. And oftentimes in those abusive relationships, it starts really early on. So maybe you've seen someone for a couple dates or a couple weeks, and it just feels over the top. I guess it's over the top pattern of behavior of expressing love and adoration and usually gestures of gift giving and doing, you know, these extravagant things as a means of trying to prove that you love this person and win them over, essentially. So it's very manipulative in intent, which I think is the important thing, is there's an intention to manipulate and to gain trust and control over the partner. And gaslighting is not necessarily part of the cycle of abuse, but it's a form of abuse and manipulation and part of that power control dynamic. So gaslighting essentially is intentionally making the other person feel as though their reality is not a reality at all. So it's intentionally telling the other person they're wrong in their perception of things, not taking accountability for things that the other person's trying to hold them accountable for. For example, say someone's partner, like, you know, a teen's partner pushes them. The next day, their partner says, I didn't push you. What are you talking about? I brushed you with my hand, or we were arguing and I just created space between us. I didn't push you. So gaslighting is essentially denying a behavior or completely disregarding the reality of the other person. And I don't like to use this word, but making the other person feel crazy as if they don't know what's going on. And so by doing that, the other person feels dumb. They feel out of touch with reality. They feel like, okay, maybe I'm wrong. And it really becomes a way of manipulation and, again, taking control of the relationship.
So we've talked about what an unhealthy relationship looks like. Can we talk a little bit about what are signs of a healthy relationship?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we need to talk more about it. But in a healthy relationship, you tend to feel respected, you feel seen, you feel heard. Really what you want to look for is feeling like you can trust your partner, feeling as though you are respected by your partner, being able to communicate in an effective and healthy way so you can express your feelings, you can have healthy and productive conversations and arguments in which both people, you might not always agree, but you still feel seen and heard and validated. It's being able to have an identity and a life outside of the relationship and not feeling like you have to give everything to your partner and drop everything for that person. So really that sense of autonomy is important in a healthy relationship as well. And just a relationship that makes you feel good and happy. And I don't think we talk about that enough. Do you feel like you can be yourself around this person? Do you feel like you have healthy self-esteem around this person? Or do you feel like you're less than around this person? Do you feel like you're always second-guessing yourself? Do you feel like you're being belittled? So really just, it's also a lot about the feeling state. Like, how do you feel around your partner? And in a healthy relationship, you should feel safe and comfortable and generally good. I mean, relationships, even teen relationships, right? There's a lot of work, there's arguments, there's conflict, but overall, you generally don't question yourself and your self-worth isn't questioned when you're in a healthy relationship.
That's really important. And I do agree that I don't think people talk enough about healthy relationships. It's more like, is your relationship bad? Here are all the negative signs. So I like shifting to the healthy because I think the more we show examples of it, talk about it, the more people can recognize when they have it good and when they're feeling good. So I want to talk about consent. What is consent and what are some examples sort of in the moment that consent might look like?
Consent is basically permission or agreeing to something. So when we think about consent, when it comes to physical intimacy with a partner, we're really having this kind of understanding with our partner, and we could talk more about how it's given or not given, but kind of you're having this understanding with your partner that you're both agreeing to what's happening. And not only are you agreeing to it, you're also enthusiastically agreeing to it. There's no hesitation. There's no doubt. It's kind of something that you're both on the same page about when consent is given. You know, in terms of like kind of what that can look like, consent can be given verbally. So this discussion of what you're going to do, what type of physical act is going to take place with the teens, you know, there can be discussions around, when we talk about this in the book, the different types of sex, whether it's whether it's intercourse or whether it's oral sex or touching or kissing. You know, consent can be given at each and every stage or act that takes place during physical intimacy. And so it can be discussed actually through a conversation, but it can also be given non-verbally. So there's cues that we can teach the teens to look out for when they are being physically intimate with a partner. And that's things like body language. So is the person really, like, if they're just kind of there and they seem really disengaged, or if they seem kind of frozen or unresponsive, like that's kind of a sign that they may not be feeling comfortable with what's happening. And on the contrary, if they're sort of leaning towards their partner, if they're actively reciprocating physically what's going on, then that's an indicator that they are into it or they are consenting. I think helping the teens to understand that consent is no longer, we used to talk about like no means no and yes means yes, and that's kind of outdated now. Consent happens through both verbal and nonverbal communication, and that's something that we want to teach the teens to look out for. And if there's a doubt in someone's mind if their partner's okay with this or not, then it's always good to stop and check in and ask, you know, are you okay with this? Are you comfortable with this? Should I keep going? Should I stop? Really encouraging open and active communication during each and every stage of physical intimacy, I think, is really important so that everyone feels comfortable.
I also think with consent that we talk about this in the book is the idea of consenting. You kind of mentioned this, but at every stage of the relationship, so you can have sex with your partner and then, you know, next time feeling like, actually, I wasn't ready for that and I don't want to consent. And I, not that I revoke it, but I'm not consenting this time. And we want to empower teens to have the ability to make a decision each and every time, even if they're with someone and they've been dating someone for months or years, even, we want to make it known that it's okay to not give consent at any stage.
Yeah. And you can revoke it, right? Like if you agree to something and then you start doing something and you realize, oh, actually, I don't like this, or all of a sudden I don't feel comfortable, then you can revoke that and say, mm-hmm. hey, you know, actually, I'm not really feeling comfortable with this. Can we stop? Mm-hmm. And so I think that, like you said, it's important for the teens to recognize that just because they agreed to something once doesn't mean that they now have to do that all the time. Mm-hmm. And knowing that, having them feel empowered to be able to do that.
That's so important. And I think we just can't talk about consent enough. So I appreciate the nuances of how it's changed, the definition of it, and at every stage, at any point in the relationship. I think that's really important and valuable to understand. And along with consent, why is talking about sexual health with your partner so important?
You know, I think this is something that teens sometimes struggle with. And I think it's a conversation that I have frequently with teens about how important it is to discuss sexual health, because it is something that, you know, like any aspect of our health, we have to take care of ourselves. We have to go to the doctor for checkups. We have to, you know, if we have symptoms of something, we get it checked out, right? And I think that in the past there, and currently there has been a lot of stigma around sexually transmitted infections and what that means if you have contracted an STI. And so in our book, we're really hoping to shift that language to, this is not something to be ashamed of. This is not something to be stigmatized. This is an aspect of our health, just like any aspect of our health. And it is something to be mindful of and to converse with your partner about. And I think for teens, it can be difficult for them sometimes to find resources to get tested, or how do I get tested, or how do I get access to condoms, or if I need birth control, like how can I do that? And in our book, we always encourage open and active communication with a teen's parent or guardian. But if that's not possible, if the teen's not comfortable, or if they need to keep it confidential, we also discuss ways that they can access treatment confidentially. And that can sometimes vary state by state, but we provide resources in the book for teens to be able to access how they can get preventative care or treatment if they need it. And so it is really important. And we talk too about the maturity. So if we kind of talk about, okay, if you're ready to have sex, then you're also ready to have this conversation about sexual health. And those two things should, if possible, go together.
Definitely agree with that. And back to a little bit about if a teen is feeling pressured on the decision to have sex with their partner, what are some sort of in the moment tools they might use to communicate that?
So this kind of also goes back to that assertiveness question and the values question too. So I think teens can draw on those things when they are trying to communicate in this kind of a situation. So if they understand their values and if they understand their limits of what they're comfortable with or not comfortable with, and if they've also gained some skills in how to be assertive, then when this situation comes up, if they're feeling pressured by their partner to do something that they're not ready for, they can use those skills to communicate it. So they could use an I statement, for example, and say, you know, I feel pressured by you, or I feel uncomfortable when, you know, I'm being put in a situation that I'm not ready for, or I'm being asked to do something that I'm not ready to do yet. And they can help their partner to see how it's impacting them. So they might say, I feel frustrated, or I feel scared, or I feel uncomfortable, or it also gives them an opportunity to say why, and to help their partner understand what they're doing that's making them feel pressured. For teens especially, it's a learning curve on both sides. Sometimes the partner who's doing the pressuring is aware of it, and sometimes they're not, and they don't realize that what they're doing is making the other person feel really uncomfortable. And so having these conversations can be useful for both partners in that situation, so that they can have open and honest discussions about what that's going to look like. One of the things we talk about in the book is that if it's continuing and the partner is not learning from this, and it's a situation where maybe someone's feeling unsafe in the relationship, or they're feeling as though this pressure is not letting up and it's becoming really a problem, you know, then that teen needs to consider if that relationship is right for them, and if they should stay in a situation where they're not feeling comfortable, and then looking at what that might be like.
And all of this whole conversation, everything you talk about in your book, leads teen girls to feeling sexually empowered. And why is that so important?
In terms of being sexually empowered, I think it really, like you said, everything combines, right? The values combine, the self-esteem combines, body image combines, all these things kind of come together in a way where if our young girls can feel empowered, that will create overall a healthier environment, whether they're in a relationship or not. And even if it's just them on their own, their relationship with themselves or with a partner, having that empowerment will enable them to have open and honest communication, healthier, more positive self-talk, and overall that ultimately will lead to healthier experiences and relationships down the line.
I was also going to say, I also think being sexually empowered is being able to know when your boundaries are crossed, or when your boundaries are not respected, that you can advocate for yourself, but also seek help. And I think we talk a lot about that in our book, is the need to ask and seek support from safe people and adults in their lives. And I think being empowered gives you that confidence to ask for support, because a lot of youth feel so much shame around their sexuality and sexual experiences.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to wrap up. Thank you so much, Leah and Geraldine. I really appreciate this really important conversation. Are you looking for clear and reliable information about relationships, sexuality, safety, and consent? You can find it in this essential guide just for teen girls. As a teen girl, you probably have a ton of questions about sex and relationships. For example, what do you do if someone sends or asks you to send an explicit picture or text? How do you know if you're straight, bi, pan, or gay? What do you do if you're being pressured to do something you don't want to do? This book has all the answers you seek. Written by two experts in teen mental health, this go-to guide offers empowering tools to help you build self-esteem, clarify your values, understand your sexual identity and boundaries, decide what feels right for you, and know what to do when things go wrong. And by practicing the simple evidence-based skills in this book, you'll learn how to handle any situation that you may encounter, whether online or IRL. As a teen girl navigating the world of sex, dating, and relationships, you need to feel empowered and confident to make important decisions for yourself that are grounded in self-respect and safety. This book can help every step of the way. Visit our website at www.newharbinger.com and use coupon code PODCAST25 to receive 25% off your entire order. New Harbinger Publications is an independent, employee-owned publisher of books on psychology, health, spirituality, and personal growth. For 50 years, our evidence-based self-help books and pioneering workbooks have helped readers make positive changes to improve mental health and well-being. Founded by psychologists Matthew McKay and Patrick Fanning, New Harbinger is proud to be an employee-owned company. Our books reflect our core values of integrity, sustainability, compassion, and trust. Written by leaders in the field and recommended by therapists worldwide, New Harbinger books are practical, accessible, and provide real tools for real change. Join the New Harbinger Clinicians Club, a free membership club exclusively for mental health professionals. Sign up today and you'll receive a special welcome gift, 35% off all professional books, free client resources, free ebooks throughout the year, access to private sales, a subscription to our Quick Tips for Therapists email program, and more. Visit newharbinger.com/clinicians-club for more information. If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love if you rated, reviewed, and subscribed to the show, and we hope you might share it with anyone who might benefit from the content. This podcast is not a substitute for counseling with a licensed provider.